I ordered my things to be packed, determining to drive to Southampton and take train thence to London. And at the same time Mrs. Temple gave instructions that all should be prepared for her own return to Royston within a few days. I knew she did not dare to see John after her daughter's death. I took my maid with me and Panham to act as courier. At London we hired a carriage for the whole journey, and from Calais posted direct to Naples. We took the short route by Marseille and Genoa, and travelled for 17 days without intermission, as my brother's note made me desirous of losing no time on the way. I have never been in Italy before, but my anxiety was such that my mind was unable to appreciate either the beauty of the scenery or the incidents of travel. I can, in fact, remember nothing of our journey now, except the wearisome and interminable jolting over bad roads and the insufferable heat. It was the middle of August in an exceptionally warm summer, and after passing Genoa the heat became almost tropical. There was no relief even at night, for the warm air hung stagnant and suffocating, and the inside of my travelling coach was often like a furnace. We were at last approaching the conclusion of our journey, and had left Rome behind us. The day that we set out from Aversa was the hottest that I have ever felt, the sun beating down with an astonishing power even in the early hours, and the road being thick with white and blinding dust. It was soon after midnight that our carriage began rattling over the great stone blocks with which the streets of Naples are paved. The suburbs that we at first passed through were, I remember, in darkness and perfect quiet. But after traversing the heart of the city and reaching the western side, we suddenly found ourselves in the midst of an enormous and very dense crowd. There were lanterns everywhere, and interminable lanes of booths, whose proprietors were praising their wares with loud shouts, and here acrobats, jugglers, minstrels, black-vested priests, and blue-coated soldiers mingled with a vast crowd whose numbers at once arrested the progress of the carriage. Though it was so late of a Sunday night, all seemed here awake and busy as at noonday. Oil lamps with reeking fumes of black smoke flung a glare over the scene, and the discordant cries and chattering conversation united in so deafening a noise as to make me turn faint and giddy, wearied as I already was with long travelling. Though I felt that intense eagerness and expectation which the approaching termination of a tedious journey inspires, and was desirous of pushing forward with all imaginable dispatch, yet here our course was sadly delayed. The horses could only proceed at the slowest of footpaces, and we were constantly brought to a complete stop for some minutes before the postboy could force a passage through the unwilling crowd. This produced a feeling of irritation and despair of ever reaching my destination, and the mirth and careless hilarity of the people round us chafed with bitter contrast on my depressed spirits. I inquired from the postboy what was the origin of so great a commotion, and understood him to say in reply that it was a religious festival held annually in honour of Our Lady of the Grotto. I cannot, however, conceive of any truly religious person countenancing such a gathering, which seemed to me rather like the unclean orgies of a heathen deity than an act of faith of Christian people. This disturbance occasioned us so serious a delay that, as we were climbing the steep slope leading up to Posilipo, it was already 3 in the morning and the dawn was at hand. After mounting steadily for a long time, we began to rapidly descend, and just as the sun came up over the sea, we arrived at the Villa de Angelis. I sprang from the carriage, and passing through a trellis of vines, reached the house. A manservant was in waiting, and held the door open for me. But he was an Italian, and did not understand me when I asked in English where Sir John Maltravers was. He had evidently, however, received instructions to take me at once to my brother, and led the way to an inner part of the house. As we proceeded, I heard the sound of a rich alto voice singing very sweetly to a mandolin some soothing or religious melody. The servant pulled aside a heavy curtain, and I found myself in my brother's room. An Italian youth sat on a stool near the door, and it was he who had been singing. At a few words from John, addressed to him in his own language, he set down his mandolin and left the room, pulling to the curtain and shutting a door behind it. The room looked directly onto the sea. The villa was, in fact, built upon rocks, at the foot of which the waves lapped. Through two folding windows which opened onto a balcony, the early light of the summer morning streamed in with a rosy flush. My brother sat on a low couch or sofa, propped up against a heap of pillows, with a rug of brilliant colours flung across his feet and legs. He held out his arms to me, and I ran to him. But even in so brief an interval, I had perceived that he was terribly weak and wasted. All my memories of his past faults had vanished and were dead in that sad aspect of his worn features, and in the conviction which I felt, even from the first moment, that he had but little time longer to remain with us. I knelt by him on the floor, and with my arms round his neck, embraced him tenderly, not finding any place for words, but only sobbing in great anguish. Neither of us spoke, and my weariness from long travel and the strangeness of the situation caused me to feel that paralyzing sensation of doubt as to the reality of the scene, and even of my own existence, which all, I believe, have experienced at times of severe mental tension. That I, a plain English girl, should be kneeling here beside my brother in the Italian dawn, that I should read, as I believed, on his young face the unmistakable image and superscription of death, and reflect that within so few months he had married, had wrecked his home, that my poor Constance was no more, these things seemed so unrealizable that for a minute I felt that it must all be a nightmare, that I should immediately wake with the fresh salt air of the Channel blowing through my bedroom window at Worth and find I had been dreaming. But it was not so. The light of day grew stronger and brighter, and even in my sorrow the panorama of the most beautiful spot on earth, the Bay of Naples, with Vesuvius lying on the far side, as seen then from these windows, stamped itself forever on my mind. It was unreal as a scene in some brilliant dramatic spectacle, but alas, no unreality was here. The flames of the candles in their silver sconces waxed paler and paler, the lines and shadows on my brother's face grew darker, and the pallor of his wasted features showed more striking in the bright rays of the morning sun.